This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're somehow confusing the fact that having more money changing hands, you know, that's not the same thing as building a better society.
Like it or not, we're all consumers to some degree. But when is enough enough exactly? This week on Sea Change Radio, we dive into two very different ends of the consumerism pool. First, we speak to the co-founder of Estancia Beef, Bill Reed, whose company is making inroads in the very competitive U.S. market by importing grass-fed beef from Argentina. We'll learn how his company can compete in both price and sustainability. Next, we hear from author Rob Dietz to discuss his thought-provoking new book, Enough is Enough, which sounds the alarm on the need to change the current internationally accepted standards for economic success. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bill Reed. He's the CEO and founder of Estancia Beef, which is a grass-fed beef producer. Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be here.
First, give us a background of this new company, Estancia Beef. You're relatively new in the industry, but making some pretty interesting inroads.
Yeah, I think we're doing some pretty exciting stuff. We're trying to change the way people think about beef. Typically in the U.S., you have a beef industry that is built on feedlots. It's built on the scale of prime, choice, and select, which is basically a measurement of fat content. And that's really the priorities behind the entire beef industry in the U.S. And over the past 5 or 10 years, I think you've seen the beef industry change a little bit with smaller local producers who are forcing or asking consumers to think about weighing different categories or different aspects of what they're eating. And it's no longer simply about prime, choice, and select. It's no longer simply about fat content. It's much more about the way the animals raise, the way the product feels in your mouth, the way it feels once you eat it, the health aspects, the hormones, antibiotics, animal welfare, the sustainability factors. I said a lot there, but there are many different factors that go into beef that range the gamut of what people care about today. And I think you're seeing people care more about different aspects than the simple metric of fat content.
And as your name implies, Estancia, you have some Argentine roots. Why don't you explain a little bit about the Argentinian beef tradition and how you're trying to incorporate that into your practices?
I'll start off with the U.S. In the U.S., the feedlots were invented in the 1950s and through subsidized corn and a really rich culture of corn. We developed the feedlot system in the U.S. and predominantly feed animals corn for a better part of their lives and produce that really rich, buttery, fatty beef. In Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and really the rest of the world, cultures have not had the luxury of excess corn, and they've really had to build their systems around a more sustainable process, not by design, more by necessity. And in doing so, they have they've built systems, whether it's genetics of the animals, whether it's pasture management, whether it's the type of grasses they plant, the methods they use to produce silage, if that's necessary. All those factors go into a much more holistic approach to beef production that is very different than kind of the factory, very linear production we have in the U.S. And what we're trying to do is take that methodology that's really been refined and perfected in what's widely known around the world as one of the great steaks of this planet. The Argentine steak is famous for a reason. We're trying to take that methodology and apply it to our processes in South America and our processes for beef production here in the U.S., which is a really simple Estancia-based method. And Estancia is the word for ranch in Spanish. It basically, to me, it connotes a farm that is self-contained, self-sufficient. In Argentina, the farms are mostly self-sufficient, and they can raise an animal from birth all the way to slaughter weight, and they do that with practices and pasture management and genetics that make that possible. They also have silage capacity if that's necessary. They have chickens, they might have pork, they have a really, they have composting. They have a very balanced approach to raising food on one farm. Whereas in the US, we've seen real specialization in our farms. Most farms raise just corn, or they raise just cow-calf operation, or they're a feedlot, and that allows for a ton of efficiency, but is not a very holistic approach. And I think with that come a lot of costs, whether it's animal welfare, sustainability, or quality.
And that feedlot system is really fueled by cheap oil, and it's really a product of the last 100 years with petroleum-based fertilizer, which has just seen this very inexpensive feed corn become more prevalent. With that, we've seen U.S. beef products spanning the globe. It's traditionally an export item. You're trying to do something a little counterintuitive. You're bringing beef into the U.S. Explain the thinking behind it and how it's cost-effective and sustainable at the same time.
Yeah, the U.S. has gotten really good at producing large quantities of very cheap, very high quality food. And we've done that across many categories in the food industry. Beef is probably a leader in that. U.S. produces very good, very cheap, very fatty, very tender beef and exports it around the world. I don't think that means it's a perfect supply chain or a perfect product. And there are a lot of consumers in the U.S. that are looking for something that's healthier, that's more sustainable, that's more thoughtful. And that's what we think we're doing. And we're taking age-old practices that have been refined in South America, and we're going to apply them to U.S. production and our existing production in South America. Now, that broadens the question to what is sustainable and what is healthy beef. To us, healthy beef is beef that's raised naturally. It's going to be lower in fat. The fat it does have is high in omega-3s. It's a natural fat, more like olive oil.
How does that compare to the feedlot fat contest? They kind of just like, it's almost like foie gras geese in that they just stuff these cows with high fat corn diets, correct?
That's correct, yeah. And the fat found in a corn-fed animal is going to have a different ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 and basically lower omega-3s. It will not have the CLA, which is conjugated linoleic acid that you find in grass-fed beef. And the short way to look at this is what the paleo diet folks think, or the caveman diet folks think, which is that the humans evolved alongside certain products that were natural and around 1,000 years ago, such as nuts and fruits and grass-fed beef. And our bodies have learned to digest that pretty effectively. Now, you introduce corn-fed beef, and our bodies don't know how to handle it as well, and it's much harder for our bodies to process the fat and the type of fats in corn-fed versus the type of fats found in grass-fed. So health is a big part of grass-fed beef, and I say health predominantly for the consumer eating it, but it's also health for our planet and health for the animals. And I think all those things are part and parcel, and that's why we like to talk about holism at Estancia, and our approach is really holistic, which is this is not simply about lower cost beef or healthier beef or better animal welfare. It's a combination of all those things that come together. And to answer your question about sustainability, what's really important with thinking about carbon footprint or sustainability in the food industry, I think, is looking at the entire life cycle of the product. And what works really well in southeastern United States, in Argentina, in Uruguay, in New Zealand, is that you have year-round rainfall, you have grasses that are growing pretty well year-round, and that means your animals can gain weight throughout the year. And when you think about the life cycle of one of our animals, they never actually come in contact with any food or any, they don't really have any carbon footprint until they go to the factory floor. And then, sure, we ship from South America to Houston, Texas by boat, but that's a very small part of the overall carbon footprint of most animals. So that's our largest carbon footprint of our animals, but animals raised in the U.S. would be raised on hay or corn or some kind of fossil-using product in order for them to gain weight throughout the year. In California, for example, most cattle feed on alfalfa for 8 to 10 months of the year. That alfalfa has to be planted, harvested, irrigated, grown, baled and distributed on a weekly basis for 10 months of the year for 3 years of the animal's life. And if you do that every single week for 3 years, that's a big carbon footprint. Even though it may be grass-fed, even though it may be local, you have a three-year carbon footprint plus shipping and distribution to the customer. Whereas with Estancia, we have no carbon footprint for the first 3 years of the animal's life, and then a little bit higher carbon footprint getting it to market. So it's a little bit of a trade-off.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the co-founder and CEO of Estancia Beef, Bill Reed. So give us an idea of what Estancia Beef needs to scale up to as a producer to be cost competitive with local grass-fed beef producers here in the U.S.
Well, today, whether it's South American beef or beef we produce in the U.S., we'll be considerably lower priced than local grass-fed beef producers, and that's more our methodology and our scale.
Even with the import cost?
The import cost and import carbon footprint are very insignificant, whether it's carbon or dollars, it's kind of one and the same, is very insignificant to our overall cost. And the real cost is growing the animal and raising the animal to slaughter weight and then processing and selling the animal. I mean, there's a cost associated with that too. Not very many people are interested in paying a premium for grass-fed leather or grass-fed tongue or grass-fed bones. Those are products that are hard to get rid of. So your premium ends up getting consolidated into the four or five cuts that people are interested in paying for. So Estancia is typically much more price competitive than local grass-fed beef. Estancia is a little bit priced higher than so-called natural U.S. corn-fed beef, which is beef raised in feedlots but not using antibiotics or hormones. And then Estancia is considerably more expensive than kind of commodity commercial beef that has no natural or humane aspects applied to it.
So when you go to the store, if they don't carry Estancia beef, you're traveling some in a state where they don't have your product, and you want to get some steaks to grill, walk us through what would inform your decision-making process.
That's a great question. I typically want to know where the beef's coming from. I'd like to know the brand or the label on it, and I can learn a lot from that. If the answer is we don't know, or you know, they have a hard time answering it, then that tells you a lot. It's probably commercial or standard commodity beef. On top of that, there's a lot that can be played with in terms of words, and there's a lot that is real. Organic is a term that I think is more effective for fruits and vegetables. Maybe grains. With beef, it gets pretty complex, and even a lot of the organic beef out there could be an old dairy cow in a feedlot eating corn. I mean, that can meet organic standards, but that's not really what people envision when they think about organic beef. And what's tricky about animals with organic label is that you have two factors. One, growing the food to an organic standard, and then raising the animals and eating that same food to the organic standard. So you kind of double your complexity, and you also double the loopholes or the ways to circumvent the rules around organic.
Bill Reed is the co-founder and CEO of Estancia Beef. Bill, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me. I love it when you call me Big Papa. Gotta cut up in your waist, please don't shoot up the place. Wow. Cause I see some ladies tonight that should be having my baby. Baby. Straight up, honey, really I'm asking. Most of these fellas just think they be macking, but they be acting. Who they attracting with that line? What's your name? What's your sign? Soon as he buy that wine, I just creep up from behind. Things to make you smile, what numbers to dial? You're gonna be here for a while. Pull the truck up front, roll up the next blunt, so we can steam on the way to the telly. Go fill my belly. A T-bone steak, cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape. Conversate for a few, cause in a few, we're gonna do what we came to do. Forget the telly, we just go to the crib and watch a movie in the jacuzzi. Smoke ales while you do it. I love it when you call me Big Papa. Throw your hands in the air, you're a true player. I love it when you call me Big Papa.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rob Dietz. He is the editor of the Daily News and the former director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. He's also the co-author of Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Rob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks a lot for having me. I'm really grateful to be here.
This is an important book in that it really takes on some of the more pressing issues, from population to something that we've had a guest on several times before, Richard Heinberg, talking about the end of growth and trying to realign our values to have constant consumption and growth not be the standard by which we grade our success as societies. Why don't you walk us first through the thought process of taking on such an enormous task here with your co-author, Dan O'Neill?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. That's a great question about why would you go about writing a book like this. And for me, I think a lot of people probably have some similar feelings about just being frustrated and overwhelmed by the disturbing environmental and social problems that we face, you know, whether it's climate change or species extinction or poverty or you know, take your pick. And I've been longing for a way out of the mess, quite frankly. And I've been really surprised at how little Washington and our politicians and our media are putting out practical and viable answers. So that's really what this book is about. It's about a practical path, a hopeful path for rebuilding the economy so that it works for people and the planet.
And do you think that the reexamination of how we value economic success will start at the academic level and then filter into the policymaking area? Or do you think it has to come from a wider swath of our population?
I think it's got to come from a wider swath. I mean, I see no evidence that our politics are moving in that direction. I mean, just look at the last election, the way that that President Obama and Mitt Romney basically fell all over each other to see who could promise the fastest growth and, you know, create the most jobs. And, you know, no attention was paid at all to an alternative to this impossibility of perpetual growth. So I think it's got to come much more broadly. And we've got a foothold in academia, but it's tiny compared to the kind of the growth cheerleading, the ever-expanding economist way that most economics courses are taught. So what I'm looking for is for the public to pick up this issue. And I think most people on a common sense level understand that infinite growth on a finite planet doesn't really make sense, but also that, hey, maybe there's a better way. And that's what we wanted to describe.
I was thinking while I was reading some of this that the international community and some of the organizations have a little less partisanship and a little less at stake politically when they would agree to maybe adding something like a global happiness index to their organization. What would it take to somehow shrink how we value GDP and GNP in our international community?
This is a really important issue because right now we're using GDP, gross domestic product, in a way that it really was never meant to be used. It wasn't built for. It's that we're using it as a measure of progress. We're somehow confusing the fact that having more money changing hands, you know, that's not the same thing as building a better society. And the good news is that we've got indices. Practice with building measures of progress that can tell us something about how well we're doing. You know, how happy are our citizens and how well are we able to meet our needs without undermining the life support systems of the planet and the ecosystems of our nation. So that's actually one of the key things that we need to get done. We've got to replace these poor measures of progress with better measures of progress, and that can help start a cascade of other changes that we need. As far as getting that going in the United States, there's already been, as you said, a movement afoot internationally, and I think we can learn from that. But I think it really does come down to widespread public awareness that that we need to be doing something different. And you know, that involves the work that you're doing, Alex, on helping people get the information they need. But I do think we need to, at every turn, challenge GDP as a measure of progress. I think it's an idea that's ready for change.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Rob Dietz. He's the co-author of Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Rob, you quote Lao Tzu in the beginning of your book, and the quote is, "A person who knows that enough is enough will always have enough." Why don't you expand on that, and what does that really mean to you? And it obviously inspired you to put it at the beginning of your book.
Yeah, well, the wisdom of Lao Tzu and some of our ancient masters, you can sit and think about what it means and really gain a lot from it. For me, I've been thinking about it for a long time, this difference between more and enough, if you think about more, sometimes, it's good to have more, especially when you don't have enough. If you're not getting enough food, having more is a good thing. If you're not getting enough sleep, then having more is a good thing. But there's always diminishing returns to more. And once you do have enough, consuming beyond that point is problematic. If you're consuming past the point of enough with food, you're likely to develop health problems. If you're sleeping past the point of enough, that could be considered a medical condition. So enough is the amount that is just right. And the question is, can we build an economy that recognizes that point of enough and grows only to its optimal size, not beyond that, which threatens both our environmental systems and our societies?
Over in Songland morning, when this life is over, I'll fly away, we'll fly away, I'll fly away, well into my home on God's shore, tell mother and I'll fly away, we'll fly away, I'll fly away, early one day and I will fly away, I'll fly away, oh, Lord, when I'll fly away, I will fly away, I'll fly away, oh Lord, and when I die, hallelujah, by and by, tell mother and I'll fly away. Oh, we'll fly away, I'll fly away. Oh, one day and I'll fly away, mm-hmm. Fly away, I'll fly away. Oh, Lord, and I'll fly away, I will fly away, I'll fly away. Well, when I die, hallelujah, bye-bye.
If you ever find yourself wanting to know more about the music we play here on Sea Change Radio, go to seachangeradio.com and click on the Music tab at the top of the page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with co-author of Enough is Enough, Rob Dietz. Rob, let's stick to the chapter on environmental issues since this is an environmental radio show. You say that ideally resource limits should be set from the top down. Now, we've seen the Kyoto Protocol sputter, and the argument is always, well, why should we, the United States, sign on if China isn't? And how can we get top-down leadership when it seems so difficult just to get very basic agreements on these pretty obvious issues facing us all?
Yeah, you've hit the probably the most important question. How can we, if our psychology, the way that we think and operate, is kind of at odds with how what we need to do to fix our problems economically, then there's trouble. I mean, we did use the word ideally. It's set from the top down, my take on it is I'm personally in favor of as much decentralization of the power and of political power and of the decision-making process as possible. But some of these issues that we face, like climate change, are global in nature. So the idea here is really to get a scientific limit at the top, lot of scientists have been talking about 350 parts per million, which we're way beyond and likely to keep going way beyond. But if you can set a limit on how much CO2 in the atmosphere we think is safe based on the science, and then you can distribute the amount of CO2 that can be released based on that in a fair way, I think that's the starting point that I'm talking about. Now, how we get nations to agree with that, again, I go back to we need widespread public awareness that continuous growth is not the answer. And once we've been able to establish that, the United States, for example, could really take a lead on this front, could make the turn toward, okay, what we're doing isn't working and it's not making us any better off. So now let's start looking at a different way. And that's going to be an economy that's not powered by fossil fuels, an economy that's based on renewable energy, and we can start taking a leadership role, and you know, regardless of what China does, but I think the international pressure will catch up with them as well.
You close the book focusing a little bit with Bill McKibben. You mentioned the 350.org, and he and his colleagues have done a tremendous amount to raise public awareness of the climate change issue. He also talks about changing the paradigm from more and better to we need more or better. And that seems to be kind of an underlining theme throughout your book. How do we start from a grassroots level, start getting that message across that we need to make that choice between more or better?
Yeah, well, I think, again, it begins with widespread understanding that that our planet is finite, but that, you know, that's okay. It's always been that way, but the understanding that there is a different option. And, you know, this different option, a steady state economy or an economy of enough, it's not out there. There's no, you know, there's no media attention, you know, aside from what you're doing here and a few others, but we don't hear about it often. You know, you mentioned before how Forbes and, you know, every business news program immediately trots out stories about continuous growth. So we need to change that, and we need to change our politicians' understanding and enable them to have the courage to talk about a completely different economic system. So that starts with the people. So, you know, we've got to get people understanding this issue.
And that kind of gets me back to my original question about academia, because a lot of these economic principles that have been absorbed by the political class came from the academic class, you know, from Keynesian economics and John Kenneth Galbraith all the way to the Laffer curve and trickle-down economics that was embraced by the right wing. How do we inculcate the next generation of political leaders with a little bit more of a holistic view of the world economy, rather than how do you get your nation on top of other nations in the global fight of constant growth?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with students. You know, economics is all about supply and demand, right? So how about students start demanding an economics program in their universities that deals with reality instead of mathematics and theory that's not working for us. And as soon as that demand creeps up, the supply of the mainstream economics that you get now is gonna drop, and we'll get a much stronger supply of ecological economics that can work for us.
The co-author of Enough is Enough, Rob Dietz, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot, Alex. Best of luck to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Meters, Alex Wise, and the CBS Trumpeteers.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com.
That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.